So I think we've got a real treat for you. This is just so you're sure you're in the right place, the Cancer Patient Reported Outcomes Surveillance Systems Measuring Impact on Population Health session. And here's a quick overview of what we're going to do today. I'm going to start by just making a few opening remarks about patient report outcomes, what they are, and what they can add to our understanding of health. And then I'll transition into a description of a study called PROCESS, which is a potential platform for PRO surveillance. And then we'll go through two other examples of potential platforms in some detail. Dr. Kent will present on the SEER Medical Health Outcomes Study, and Dr. Weaver will present on the National Health Interview Survey and the Quality of Life and Survivorship modules that have been added to that. And then we'll close with our discussant, Dr. Yabrov, who we are very thankful to for filling in for Dr. Lipscomb, who unfortunately could not make it to the conference. And I am Tenbrook Smith. I'm the Director of Patient Reported Outcomes Research at the American Cancer Society. So I guess the core thing that patient reported outcomes do is describe patient functioning and well-being. And by collecting PRO data, we can enhance our understanding of cancer burden and the impact of interventions, too. Here's a nice definition of PROs from the International Society of Quality of Life Research. And it says that PROs are any report of status that comes directly from the patient without interpretation of the patient's response by a clinician or anyone else. And that's that essential thing. It's bringing you the patient perspective. And here's some of the domains that are measured by PROs. I think maybe the real core domains of these top three symptoms are specific things like pain, fatigue, emotional distress. Functional status are things like activities of daily living. Then you have the broader construct of health-related quality of life, which often is divided into physical, emotional, and social well-being, and sometimes you have multidimensional scales that cover multiple different aspects of it. And then there are patient perceptions of care, which some people call patient-reported experience measures as opposed to PROs, but for the purposes of this slide, I'm not going too deeply into that whole discussion. But those can include things like how the patient values the care, the patient's perceptions of the provider's communication, which can be really important in that arena. And then finally, you could also include health behaviors in there. So one important thing to know about PROs is that they can provide precise, valid, and reliable data on patient perspectives when developed and administered properly, and I'll emphasize that last bit. So developed and administered properly, there's a whole science to developing PROs. There's psychometrics, there's characteristics. So if you're new to the area, it probably is worth interacting with an expert because you can get it wrong, and then your data can be useless. So make sure you do it right. So now I'm just going to give a couple of examples of how PROs are typically used, or I think the most typical use really is in symptom assessment in the clinical setting. They're really the preferred approach to symptom assessment. As according to a number of different guidelines, I listed a couple here, but there's many more I could have listed. And then also in clinical trials, the FDA and this European agency, which is the FDA's equivalent, have recognized how important PROs, and then to the point where for certain labeling, for certain types of labeling, you actually have to have PRO data. And then perhaps most relevant to this group is the CDC's Healthy People 2020 goal, which is to improve health-related quality of life and well-being for all individuals. So I think this is a new goal. I think it's only about a year old, actually. They've been working in this area for a long time, and I think for a while they had sort of a developmental goal of, hey, we want to do something, but we're not sure what to do. So now on the website, we just looked about, was that 2 or 3 days ago we looked, and they have listed the NHIS survey, the National Health Interview Survey, which you'll hear a lot more about later. But I just wanted to point out that they're using this measure called the PROMISE Global 10 Health-Related Quality of Life Measure, which is part of the PROMISE initiative that I'll talk about in just a minute. And I wanted to specifically point out that it includes individual questions on pain, fatigue, and emotional distress. So what is PROMISE? PROMISE is the Patient Reported Outcomes Measurement Information System, and it is an NIH initiative. It's a system of reliable and precise measures of patient-reported health status for physical, mental, and social well-being. One of the big advantages of PROMISE is that it uses item response theory to develop these item banks. So the item banks are a series of questions that describe or collect data on a specific construct like fatigue. And then what item response theory does, I don't have time to go into the details, but basically what it does is it allows you to create a more precise, shorter measurements than you would using classic test theory. So it's very cool. It's really neat. And then you can conduct surveys either by creating sort of a static, standard sort of paper and pencil type of question or a precise short form, but the best way is computer adaptive testing because that takes advantage of item response theory. So just to kind of summarize, I think some of the key points about PROs is that they reflect the patient experience and that they can improve understanding of population health. And one of the things I thought I'd take out of the area of cancer survivorship, where I do a lot of my work, is this idea of, you know, cancer survivorship, it's not just about survival. It's also about surviving with a good quality of life. And so if we really want to understand that aspect of people's lives, we probably need to use PROs. So now I'll present on cancer patient perceptions of symptom care collected using a registry-based system suitable for PRO surveillance, and I'll just kind of echo again this last bit, I think, for this presentation. So what I'm presenting on is a registry-based system that we use to collect PROs. And here's the team that I work with, and I want to acknowledge Alyssa, who's hiding out in the back row there. I don't think Ken made it in yet. And we got funding from ACS and NCI, so thank you for those to those organizations. So here, why do we do this? Okay, so this table represents National Cancer Outcomes Surveillance platforms in different areas, right? And you can see there's a lot of great platforms you can use for prevention and detection. You've got these national health surveys, incidence and mortality. You've got the state cancer registries. You can even look at patterns of care using Medicare data or cancer registries. But when it comes to quality of life, there's really sort of a gap. And I actually developed this slide a couple years ago. Now I think there are these efforts, and you're going to see actually each of our presentations really talks to trying to fill the gap with different approaches. So maybe I need to update that soon and not just have the dashes there. But I think each of these presentations represents relatively new efforts in this area. So I guess the next question could be, well, okay, so you're going to do quality of life, but gosh, quality of life covers so many different things. What are you going to do? And so for the project that I'm going to present on, we chose symptoms because they're a really important aspect of patient-centered care, and they also impact other things that we're really interested in, like overall quality of life or disability and return to usual activities or even treatment completion. In fact, symptoms are one of the leading reasons why people don't complete guideline treatment, and then that can lead to increased mortality. So there's actually even a way where sort of this quality of life PRO construct starts circling back and having an impact on mortality. The circles across the bottom just are supposed to represent this idea that symptoms sort of act as a conduit between cancer and cancer treatment, and then quality of life and adjustment and other larger scale outcomes that we might be interested in. So for example, a woman might be diagnosed with breast cancer, and then she might have chemotherapy, and then as a symptom she'd experience fatigue, and then she was unable to go back to work for a while because of that. Then specifically, we chose to focus on, again, there's a lot of different symptoms you could look at. So we chose to focus on pain, fatigue, and emotional distress as three of the most common and distressing symptoms across cancer types. I'll just do that too. So what I'm presenting on today is process or the patient-reported outcomes, symptoms, and side effects study. And the aims of the study were to pilot test a cost-effective method for collecting patient-reported data on symptom experiences that could be used for surveillance, things like, let's say, prevalence of pain among cancer patients, at the institutional and then in the future population levels. So this is not a population-based study at this time. But we designed it in a way that we could scale it up to be population-based in the future. We also wanted to describe the prevalence and predictors of symptoms and patient perceptions of symptom care, and then we wanted to pilot the development of actionable symptom management quality improvement reports based upon patient-reported data. So we're sort of taking a page out of the community participatory research book here. We're not just going to go grab our data from these cancer centers and be on our way to publish our papers and pat ourselves on the back. We're going to actually take this data, put it in a format that's useful to the cancer centers, and feed it back to the cancer centers. So now on to methods. I want to acknowledge NCI's really important contributions to this study. First of all, The data that I'm presenting today and sort of the number of the core measures in the study, actually there's also some promise measures, but I'm not presenting those today, came from NCI initiatives. They were based on measures that were developed in previous NCI projects, so that was really sped up our project development. And we also conducted the study with the NCI Community Cancer Centers program, which is closing down in another couple of months, but it was really a great advantage to our study. And one of the big advantages it gave us was it allowed us to conduct the study in multiple, 17 different cancer centers across the country. They were all community cancer centers. They weren't elite academic cancer centers. So we know that the majority of cancer patients receive their treatment at community cancer centers like these. So it gives us a little bit more generalizability, even though we're not making claims about being population-based. Now, this is perhaps the most innovative aspect of the study. It's that we used the American College of Surgeons Rapid Quality Reporting System. But before I explain how we used it, I need to explain what it does, just so you know what it is. Basically, it's a registry-based system intended to promote evidence-based cancer care in real clinical time. And you can see here there's this sort of dashboard that participating cancer centers get, right? And basically, what's on that dashboard, it shows them what proportion of their patients are adhering to a variety of different quality indicators. So for example, what proportion of their patients are receiving radiation treatment within 12 months of diagnosis among patients that had breast-conserving surgery, okay? So that's really a cool feature, right? I mean, it's part of this vision of the registry becoming more than just a data repository. It's going to now feed the data back. But the thing is that to do that, the cancer centers have to report their data in much more rapidly than they would to a standard cancer registry. And this is really the crux of what we took from it. So for our study, we didn't use the dashboard. We're just a standard sort of paper and pencil, primarily paper and pencil data collection effort, and we provided a summary report at the end of the year. But what it did do for us was allow us to get at patients around the time of treatment. You can't do that using standard registry data because it's not ready till 1 or 2 years after diagnosis. So it, in essence, gave us rapid case ascertainment at no additional cost to us or the cancer centers because they're already doing that as part of their standard operating procedure. And that's the real advantage of this, the major advantage of this. We knew if we wanted to do pain, we needed to survey people around that time. It also automated sampling, which allowed us to lower burden on hospital staff and also protected patient confidentiality. And it also provided registry-based variables for our data set when we were done. So here's a very quick sketch of the methodology for the study. I'm happy to talk in detail about it to anybody who's interested at a later time. We sampled breast and colon cancer patients 4 to 12 months from diagnosis using RQRS. The core of the study is patient-reported data on symptoms, perceptions of symptom care, and barriers to care, and we collected that primarily with a mail questionnaire. If there was a web option, we got about 9% of people using the web option. And our mantra when we were designing the study was to maximize scalability and minimize costs. So again, this idea that we want to be able to scale this up later. So we had a short questionnaire. We utilized partner resources, and we minimized demands on cancer center staff. So at the end of the day, what we ended up with was 17 cancer centers, 61% response rate, and 2,500 completed questionnaires, approximately 2,500. So now on to results. I'm not going to go through the exclusion criteria in detail here, but I just want you to be aware that we did have to filter some people for this analysis, so it's not the complete data set. So here, one of the things you'll notice right away is that we have a lot more breast patients than colon patients. That really just reflects how RQRS was operating at the time that we did this study, which was sort of early in RQRS's life. And this is the first study to use RQRS in this way for collecting PRO data and sampling patients. I'll also point out that while our proportion of minorities, non-Hispanic, blacks, and Hispanics isn't that large, it's fairly representative of the population we were trying to sample from, and also there are enough, given our large sample size, that we can look at these groups individually. Here, I just want to make the point that we have a good number of people who had a high school grad or less level of education, and people over 65 also, well represented in our data set. Here, the big point I want to make is no stage 4, so no distant disease. This was intentional part of our design. We were only looking at people with local or regional cancers. And then time since surgery, I'll just summarize on this next slide. When you take the three modalities, surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, and combine them, the The large majority of our sample has had treatment within the last 6 months. That's important because the recall period on our items, on our questions that I'm going to present to you, is 6 months. So here's our first real interesting result, right? Okay, so this is patients bothered by the symptoms, in essence, the prevalence of these symptoms. And I think these numbers are very similar to what you would see if you read through the literature. Fatigue is commonly thought to be the most prevalent symptom. Almost 3/4 of people are reporting on having that. And pain is very common also. And then emotional distress is the least common of these three, but again, you've almost got 50%, so even though it's the least common of these three, it's still probably something we really need to deal with because you've got one in two people saying they have that problem. And then this is one of our measures. Now we're kind of shifting gears. This is their patient perception of care, right? So this is patients saying that they got advice about what to do if the symptom started, came back, or got worse from healthcare providers, okay? And you'd really like to see these numbers a little higher because according to symptom care guidelines, everybody's supposed to be asked about these things, right? Now, you're not going to necessarily expect it to get up to 100% because we know that patients aren't going to perfectly remember everything that a doctor or health provider says to them. But you'd like to see these a little higher. And I think it's interesting to note that even though fatigue was the most common symptom, here it's behind pain. It's not too surprising because pain is... there's a lot of focus on pain, and there's a little bit of confusion about what best to do with people who are experiencing fatigue. And then emotional distress is the least common here. So with these patient perception measures, we wanted to show site level variation because we think this is suggestive that there actually is something we could do to improve those numbers. So what you can see here is that it starts from the lower performing hospitals only indicating about just a little under 40% of their patients are saying that they got advice about this symptom, which is emotional distress in this one, all the way up to almost 80% in the highest performing hospital. So you figure, those lower performing hospitals probably can improve. And we actually did a case mix adjusted version of this graph, and it really didn't change very much. So now I just want to briefly mention that we considered a lot of different variables, or a good number of different variables for the models that I'm about to present, and a bunch of them didn't make it. And perhaps the most surprising one to me was race ethnicity, which really didn't show up on any of the advice or bothered items. We have three of each, one for each symptom: pain, fatigue, and emotional distress. It showed up for one advice question in univariate analysis, but it actually was a non-significant trend. It wasn't a less than 0.05 value. So that I was a little surprised by that, but I'm not sure what to make of it. So here is the result of three different logistic regressions. You can see each column here is a regression, and we're just showing the odds ratios to try to keep it big enough that you can kind of see what's going on. And it's a pretty simple story, really. The older people are less likely to indicate that they're bothered by these symptoms. Also, people who had colon cancer were less likely to indicate that they were bothered by these symptoms, and that effect is independent of gender, although there is a gender effect for some of these specific symptoms where females are a bit more likely to indicate that they're bothered by them. And then, not surprisingly, chemotherapy within the last 6 months is associated with an increased risk of these different symptoms, especially fatigue. And we know that chemotherapy has these iatrogenic effects, so this is no surprise. To some degree, maybe a validation of the measures. So now we go to similar models, but these are predicting the advice, so this is the perception of care item. And we can see that actually the pattern is very similar. I'm just going to go back one time. So I sort of skipped education because there's not a lot happening there, right? Similarly, I'm going to skip stage here. But you can see, again, the older people are less likely to indicate they're getting advice. The colon cancer patients less likely to indicate they're getting advice. And the people with chemotherapy in the last 6 months are more likely to indicate they got advice. And so it occurred to us that, people who are bothered by a symptom, then they end up being the same people who get advice about symptoms. They're sort of driving the conversation, which isn't ideal, but at least if the conversation's happening for all of them, then that might be okay. And so, yes, those two things are strongly related, but when we run this model and we use bother as a control variable, the odds ratios stay very similar. So that tells us that these predictors are operating on the advice variables independently of the bother. So now I'll just quickly give you a sketch of the Cancer Center Symptom Management Quality Improvement Reports, which was the third aim of the study that I talked about when I first, at the end of the introduction to this presentation. And you can see on the left, here's a picture of the cover of the report. It's a mock report. This data is mock data. And then this slide here sort of represents one of the graphs that we showed them. And basically the purpose of the report was to provide the cancer centers with their own center-specific estimates and then also study-wide estimates on key variables so they could see how they were doing compared to the group overall. And you can see for this cancer center, the blue bars represent their performance. They're underperforming compared to the study-wide estimate. And quite honestly, I think if we're really going to set the bar, if we go move forward and do this at a bigger level, we might set the bar a little bit higher than just the study-wide mean. So now, a few quick conclusions. One is the first aim, which was to pilot this method. And obviously, I feel like this was very successful. We had a really high response rate. We had low cancer center staff burden. It only took about 4 hours a month for cancer centers to conduct the study because a lot of the things that they would do were automated by our QRS, and then there were some other aspects of the way we did it that also reduced their burden. And then I'll also mention, I didn't put a bullet here for it, but I think I'm still doing pretty well on time, right? That we have... we had only about 4% of sample cases become ineligible. So we had a 96% eligible rate, which is really nice because, you know, the RQRS is a living database. They're updating it constantly. So there was a little bit of question about what might happen. And we did have a few people who initially, you know, the initial data that was entered showed them to be eligible, but later maybe their stage advanced and they were no longer eligible. So here, I'm just going to summarize our findings, the ones that I presented here. So symptoms were prevalent in 1/2 to 3/4 of patients, depending on the specific symptom, pain, fatigue, or emotional distress. Then 1/3 to 1/2 of patients did not recall getting advice about these, and we'd really like to see that higher, given that symptom care guidelines suggest that everybody should be given some discussion of these issues. Important risk factors included age, colon cancer, and chemotherapy. And paths to intervention, sort of what might we do to try to improve this? We could do patient-provider education. There's still a lot of people who don't really understand how common these symptoms are, and that could help. And that there are things we can do to help. And then we could increase adherence to symptom treatment guidelines. So here, strengths and limitations. So this is sort of... not just of the study, but of the methodology, I guess, that was used in the study. I think the major strength is that this is a replicable method of surveying patients during treatment, right? So, and it's also consistent across cancer centers. So unlike a clinical trial, which is really usually sort of a one-off thing, this is something we could do again. We could do it larger. And they're really, when we set out to do the study, we didn't find another way to do this. And I know the people who are working on cancer CAPS, they're struggling with this issue too, of how to have a consistent way of sampling patients across cancer centers. It's not an easy nut to crack, and this is an approach that works. Another advantage is it provides medical data on cancer, stage, histology, et cetera. And then you can use that in your design. So we could, like here we specifically sampled breast and colon patients. We could also specifically sample prostate. We could, let's say, decide, okay, we're going to try to do this nationwide. We want to hit the four top cancers, so we'll do prostate, breast, colon, lung, you know, something like that. So you don't have to necessarily do it exactly the way we did it, but it allows you to do intentional sampling and get that data at the time of diagnosis when we know a lot of problems start for patients. So in terms of limitations, one limitation is that it's an original data capture. The other approaches you're going to see later have the advantage of sort of either being a linking effect, where you're linking existing data sets, or an addition to a sort of larger public health data collection effort. And so doing those sorts of things is not easy. It's difficult. It's challenging. But it's not as expensive as launching an entirely new data collection effort. So the cost, I think, is the major limitation to this approach. Also, a limitation is we lack treatment details. So we do get treatment data both from the registry and from patient report. And by the way, I really like our treatment questions. They work really well. But we don't know a specific chemo agent. We don't know the dose. So that is a bit of a limitation when you're looking at late effects and things like that that we know are caused by specific chemo agents. We also lack a cancer-free comparison group. So we can't really say how these people are doing versus other people, but given the focus of the study, that may be okay. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that it's not longitudinal data. You could use this methodology to initiate a longitudinal cohort study if you wanted to, but that wasn't what we did here. So in terms of future directions, I'm really not going to say too much about this because we're still trying to get our first publications out of this data set, but basically we know that it would require new, larger samples to track population trends over time. One of the ideas here is that you could draw down samples, let's say every 2 to 3 years, and look at how things are going with cancer patient symptoms and their perceptions of symptom care. So we're starting to talk to our partners about that, but we don't have any really concrete plans.